Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Clayton, what if I told you a medical doctor could prescribe legal drugs and be charged as a drug trafficker?
Wait a minute, a doctor? Like, you're talking about a real doctor?
Yeah, medical doctor.
Not a dealer.
A doctor, not a dealer.
A new law means doctors are now only able to write a prescription for a 3-day supply of opioids, or if medically necessary, 7 days.
Well, I mean, the thing is that we're lying. 80% of the people who are getting in trouble are not prescribed these drugs.
Stricter regulations aimed to stop people from misusing prescription drugs are leaving patients who use opioids responsibly with greater challenges to get their medication.
We have made it much worse and more people are dying.
If I didn't have just a little bit that I'm getting, I can't even imagine what I would do.
I understand that people overdosed and died, but I didn't do any of that, and I actually need the medicine.
I'm Greg Glaude.
I'm Clayton Ingram.
And this is The War on Drugs. Clayton, what's going on, man?
What's up, Greg?
Doing great. Really excited about this topic. I mean, one of the things that we've learned is the drug war, you don't have to be a drug addict. You don't have to be in the criminal justice system. You don't have to be involved in any of this stuff. Like, it's going to impact you. And
yeah.
We were chatting before and talking about, like, being back in high school and starting to hear about, like, people taking pills and, like, these things. You're like, what is it?
Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up in a pretty white suburb, you know, outside of Annapolis, Maryland. And was that your same experience within, like, the black community as well? Like, listen to this? Or, like, how did this all – when was the first time you heard about, like, Oxy and opiates? And
I'm trying to think back when I first realized what was going on, I guess, as far as, like, the opioid epidemic. You know, the crack epidemic, saw that. You knew about that. It was prevalent. It was heavy in the black community. Mm-hmm. And the opioids, like, I don't guess I knew they were opioids. I just knew people popped pills.
Yeah, it's pill popping. Yeah, that's what it
was. Eighth grade, well, for me, probably going into high school. Mm-hmm. Oxycodone, I remember those. Never partook, but remember those being a thing. Very popular. All the stuff around codeine.
Yeah.
And then I guess I didn't realize, like, for black people, you know, syrup. Lean, codeine, that's also opioid. I think a lot of times we associate, oh, that's white people's drugs. It's like, no, it's the same thing.
Just
one
branded
is just
a little
liquid
differently.
It might taste a little
and
bit
grape.
Better.
Yeah,
over ice in a styrofoam cup. It's slushy. It is delicious.
Speaking
I
of
have
beating the heat
that,
in the summer, but, have you tried lean? Yeah.
Yeah, it'll definitely
be. Hi,
a
little Wayne
yeah.
here for.
Oh, yeah. Man. I would highly not recommend I don't know if I knew it was an epidemic, but I knew something was going on with as far as people pill popping and like being a problem. When it was a kid at my school, I think he rode my bus and he was on something. And I think somebody asked what he was on. He told everybody that he took the medicine that was for his cat.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was a cat. I don't know what it, but I'm like, you come on, man. You're going to grow whiskers. You don't know what's going to happen, man.
No idea.
You're going to start licking yourself. It's going to be weird. So I knew then, I was like, you may have a problem if you're taking medication that was prescribed for your cat.
Maybe they're getting the good shit and we're, yeah, listen.
It's probably the same. Who's making cat medicine? Nobody's making separate medicine for cats. That's a myth.
But it is like one of those things where like you think it's something and then you start to learn about it more and it's something else. Because like I think we all know some of the stories of like Purdue Pharma, mm-hmm. they're marketing these opioids. They're pushing and pushing and saying they're not addictive.
Right.
They can be addictive.
Right.
And now people are using so much when they don't need to just for the price. And then you're kind of like, all right, well, let's stop prescribing these things.
Right.
But what we always do is like instead of just solving that little problem with a little scalpel, we bring the fucking machete. And we just start hacking everything to bits.
Right.
And so now people who actually need this medication to just function can no longer get it because we have no idea how just to like solve one problem, not exacerbate another. And
right.
So we're going to talk to Maya Salovitz today. She's an amazing, amazing expert on this issue, has her own real life experience recovering from addiction, and now works to allow people to understand like what addiction means and what it is. And she's going to talk about a lot of the complications now with the regulations and prohibition of prescription opiates and how that's impacting people.
Yeah. It's going to be people that abuse everything. And it's just a shame that some of the people that need it most got to suffer.
And I think you don't have to be a drug dealer for the war on drugs to affect you.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little bit older. Clint, I'm sure you've woken up out of bed a couple of times with, you know, back sore, something like that.
Yeah.
Are we just one, you know, fender bender away from needing some sort of prescription like
right.
this, and how's that going to impact you?
You never know till you put in that situation, or it's one of your loved ones who
right.
you got to watch in unbearable pain.
Yeah. Like I said, really, really excited about this interview. Maya Salovitz is one of the foremost experts on addiction in the world. We were lucky enough to be able to interview her for the War on Drugs. So everyone, I really appreciate y'all listening and tuning in. Let's get to it. Welcome to the War on Drugs podcast, Maya. Really great to have you here.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think we're living in this almost twilight zone time with the opioid epidemic, and I see so many parallels with so many other wars that we fought within narcotics. But this one's a little bit more unique because, you know, it's actual pharmaceuticals that are being created by private entities that are within those medical communities. I think a lot of people are familiar with how when OxyContin came out, people were kind of misled on the potential complications of it. It was seen as a less addictive opioid, which doesn't really, you know, necessarily exist.
Actually, the thing that is so messed up about our narrative about this is that like every piece of it is problematic.
Right.
It is the case that longer acting opioids cause less reinforcement than shorter acting ones.
Right.
When people have to do it every 5 minutes, it's really a lot more reinforcing, which is why the fentanyls, which are more shorter acting, are much more dangerous than something like methadone. So, okay, Purdue lied, and they also claimed that OxyContin acted for 12 hours when it actually only works for 8, which was an outright lie. But the thing that people really misunderstand about the opioid crisis is that 80% of people who misuse prescription opioids do not have a prescription for them.
Right,
right.
80% of the people who are getting in trouble are not prescribed these drugs. So it wasn't like, oh, I went to my doctor and my doctor turned me into an addict. That is not what happened in the vast majority of cases. The other reason that this is the case is because 90% of addiction starts when people are in their teens or early 20s. And most people with chronic pain, speaking in broad generalities, are middle-aged or older. If you've gotten to the point of being middle-aged or older without developing any addictions, your odds of developing one are indeed less than 1%. The reality is people have different levels of risk. And the level of risk that you experience in medical care when you are older and don't have a prior addiction is very different from the risk that is encountered by people who are using drugs recreationally.
Right.
And so if you look at people who try heroin, the addiction rate there is about 10 to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? It's partially because who tries heroin? People who are serious risk takers,
right.
People who have just given up. So you're already selecting for people who are at high risk before they even take the drug. It's really important to recognize this, not to say that like, oh, people in pain can never get addicted. No, it's just to say addiction is much more than exposure. And if we continue to see it as exposure, we will end up doing exactly what we're doing, which is we have cut the medical opioid supply by 60% or more. And we did most of that by cutting off people who were on high doses for long term. And what do we find out when we do that to people? They are four times more likely to die of overdose or suicide. So we have made it much worse. And if you just look at the numbers, opioid prescribing starts falling significantly in 2011. If you look at the line on the graph of overdose death, it's going way up as the medical supply goes down. In fact, more right. people are dying.
You got to get it from somewhere.
You yeah. know, right. And so like,
right, exactly.
I don't understand.
And right. we're falling in the same cycles that we always have. When the crack epidemic started coming off, it's like, there's a problem. Things are happening. What are we going to do about it? Let's get rid of mm-hmm. essentially treatment and just crack down these people and throw them in prison.
Yeah.
You saw this in the 1920s with heroin, and doctors are pleading, please let us continue to prescribe to these individuals or we're just going to have millions of addicts. And you're seeing the exact same thing with this opioid epidemic. And yeah, Maya, if you could kind of like talk about that shift, because we did see that opioid overdoses were going up. We started blaming the pharmaceutical companies and OxyContin being out there and how that was a gateway into all these other worse behaviors. And you slowly started seeing states put together, you know, inventory lists of who's prescribing, how much.
Well, I mean, the thing is that we're lying.
Okay.
We are claiming that now that it's white people who we see as addicted, we're not using the criminal justice system.
Right.
And that's not true. What you see is we're not criminalizing people directly. We're just cutting off their source of medical opioids. So the people who were going to pill mills mostly did not get arrested. The people who ran the pill mills did get arrested, but the customers were just left. That created this disaster. Some of the reporting in this area focuses on how when the pill mills got shut down, a lot of gangs began introducing heroin to rural areas where it previously hadn't been.
Yeah.
We had a golden opportunity every time we shut a pill mill down to prescribe medical opioids just to keep people from entering withdrawal until we can stabilize them somewhere.
And like you had all these people's names. You have a database.
Yeah.
When you shut down a pill mill, it's like these are the people that are on these pills. Like right here.
Yeah. Like it's like, you know, you don't usually get a list of customers for
right.
your drug deal.
Yeah. 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 A ledger. A
yeah.
whole,
and the ledgers aren't really using Christian names of
yes,
all their clients.
Yes,
I don't. Yeah. I don't
yes.
believe either. Yeah.
And another thing that you said was the pain patients just turning into heroin buyers or whatever. That's actually more dangerous for them. If you're a person who suffers from pain, now you're going to go into a situation where people know you have money. You probably can't fight back the best. You may even be getting a check from the government every month. Like, you're a piggy bank rolling up to shark-infested waters. It's,
yeah.
it's crazy.
So what often happens in that instance is that the pain patients don't turn to the illegal market, but turn to a gun and die.
Wow.
And I have heard many horrible stories. One of them I remember specifically where this guy got cut off by his doctor and his wife held his hand while he shot himself because she knew that he couldn't live like that. It's just, who is helped by this?
Right.
It's all about let's get the numbers down. It has nothing to do with let's actually help people. And, you know, they think like, well, we can show that we reduced opioid prescribing by X percent.
Right.
Well, great. Did the patients die?
Yeah. Right. The thing that's always never brought up is patient outcome. Is that becoming better with these things? And I kind of want to nail down on that because you mentioned the reductions in prescriptions. What is causing this vast reduction in prescriptions? Like, what are the actual factors going into denying people essentially the care that they
yeah.
need?
Yeah. Well, so what basically is happening is that the law is really vague. According to a 1919 Supreme Court decision, it is not legitimate medicine to prescribe for the comfort of somebody with addiction. It's fine to prescribe for their comfort if they have pain, but not if they have addiction. And this is sort of made into the Controlled Substances Act. And right now, we have doctors who are literally being prosecuted for prescribing to people when they believed that they were treating pain, but the DEA says it's over X dose, which was in the CDC guidelines, and therefore it's not legitimate medicine and they are unconsciously becoming drug dealers. So the easy way to deal with this is just not prescribe. And what doctor is going to risk their license or their freedom because some of these really difficult patients that they don't really want to deal with anyway, because chronic pain is really hard to treat. We can just, you know, I'm sorry, we don't use opioids anymore. Go to a pain management clinic and they have waiting lists and are not available locally in a lot of places. And also if you're a patient and you travel to get your pain care, that's a red flag. So the prescription drug monitoring thing will flag you and the pharmacist will say, I won't fill your prescription because you went to like a doctor in California instead of New York. It's terrified a lot of doctors who would otherwise just maintain these patients into cutting them off and just getting them out of their practice however they can. You know, I've heard about quite a few good doctors who thought they were doing the right thing. Sometimes they got fooled by people with addiction, but doctors don't have a lie detector any more than police people do.
Right.
But again, if I fool you and get drugs from you and go and overdose, why is that your fault?
Right.
Right.
Maya, one of the things that sticks out to me is how you make a separation between what you say are the high-risk drug users, addicts, versus people who actually have pain and need some type of relief. And I think when people hear about the war on drugs, they think, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with me. I'm not a drug user. We're in the suburbs. My kids are good. You know what I'm saying? The only thing I'm addicted to is Starbucks. Yeah, lock those people up for as long as you can. Throw away the key. Take away their drugs any way necessary. But I think everybody at some stage in their life is going to come to a point where you might have somebody in your family who has cancer. You might have somebody who suffered, like we spoke about earlier, a tragic accident. And this is when I kind of realized, like, oh, the war on drugs affects everybody. Just, it may not have affected you yet. And this is one of those instances where you can kind of clearly see that.
Absolutely. I mean, prescribing of opioids for terminal cancer has fallen by 40% during this period.
Wow.
And
jeez.
The CDC guidelines explicitly exempted both cancer and sickle cell. And you can be prone to having strokes if you have that.
Yeah.
And people go in the hospital and they are having a stroke and the doctors think they're overdosing and they don't treat the stroke. And if they don't have an advocate there, they can die of that.
Wow.
I hear from these people all the time, like from people with chronic pain and people with terminal pain, where the pharmacist laughs at them. And one of the things I've really tried to do is connect the harm reduction addiction community with the chronic pain patient community, because we really should be both on the same side.
Right.
It's not that the people with addiction want nobody to ever have opioids. I mean, one of the things that I think is crazy is that, like, okay, you're in the hospital, you get opioids. You're not going to grow a drug dealer on the way out.
Right.
Like, you know, it's not the exposure to euphoria that turns people into people with addiction. It's the lack of stuff in the rest of their life.
Exactly. Clayton wasn't cheap to get, so we had to cut a couple commercials. We'll be right back.
Somebody got to pay me.
Hi, I'm Jason Flom, CEO and founder of Lava for Good Podcasts, home to Bone Valley, Wrongful Conviction, The War on Drugs, and many other great podcasts. Today, we're asking you, our listeners, to take part in a survey. Your feedback is going to help inform how we make podcasts in the future. Your complete and candid answers will help us continue to bring you more insightful and inspiring stories about important topics that impact us all. So please, go to lavaforgood.com/survey and participate today. Thank you for your support.
The War on Drugs podcast is sponsored by Stand Together, the philanthropic community that partners with America's boldest change makers to tackle the root causes of our country's biggest problems. More than 25 years ago, Alice Marie Johnson experienced personal difficulties that led to single parenthood and unemployment, all while grieving her son's death in a motorcycle accident. Although she had never previously possessed or sold an illegal substance, Faced with foreclosure on her family home, Alice made a mistake and was charged in a drug conspiracy. She was sentenced to life without parole, plus 25 years, for a first-time nonviolent offense. However, her faith sustained her through her daunting and draconian life sentence, during which she helped other women and became a certified hospice worker, ordained minister, and playwright. After serving 21 years, an advocacy campaign led to Alice's sentence commutation in 2018 and an official pardon in 2020. Today, Alice works tirelessly in the fight to reform the criminal justice system, helps others earn and receive a second chance, and she serves as the CEO of Taking Action for Good. To learn more about Stand Together, their partners, or how you can partner with Stand Together, go to standtogether.org.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey, your experience, and, you know, what worked for you and what do you think is the most critical aspect that I think that'll be helpful for people to really realize, like, what works and what doesn't?
Sure. So a very short version would be that I was a really geeky kind of Aspie sort of kid, and I felt really disconnected from people, and drugs were the first interest that I had, like previous ones involved things like opera and science fiction. Drugs were a thing that other people actually did want to hear me talk about. In fact, they still do. You know, so that led to some issues, eventually led to me getting arrested, getting expelled from Columbia, and all kinds of things like Columbia, the college, not the country.
I was about to say, if you got expelled from Columbia for cocaine, you had quite a
bit. Yeah.
Maya, were you in the Sinaloa cartel? Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
No. I mean, I was definitely selling coke in the 80s at Columbia, but not in Columbia. So anyway, when I got to college, I was just like, what do I do with all these prep school people that I just feel I can't connect to? I feel like completely less than and unable to figure out, you know, a way to get together. But if I had cocaine, I got invited to the parties and all of the things, you know. Then I got suspended from school. And then I decided I'd already ruined my life, so I may as well do heroin. And that did not help. Although at first it seemed like it helped, because part of the reason that we have our own brain opioids, endogenous opioids in our heads, is to make social connections soothing.
Right.
And
right.
So when you feel like the warmth of a hug, or you look at a cute baby, or you see your beloved person, that's opioids. That's our natural opioids doing their natural job and making you feel warm, safe, loved, and comfortable. And so somebody who doesn't have that social connection and feels really isolated suddenly experiences that. Mm. Not surprisingly, they're going to love it. And not surprisingly, it can cause a problem.
Right.
And so I basically declined from there. I got arrested. I continued to use for another 2 years. Yeah, I was just like shooting up 40 times a day at the end. I weighed 80 pounds. I looked terrible. I felt terrible. And I eventually just realized that I am addicted and I need help.
Right.
And so I called my parents and got into treatment, basically. I had to stop at court because I had a court date that day and I knew my dad would be there. And I said, I'm getting help. This is not working. And I then chose to go to treatment and they have been in recovery since. The thing is that we can't base policy on anecdote. The treatment that I went through was your traditional 28-day, 12-step based treatment. And I was told this is the only way. And if you don't do this, the only alternative is jails, institutions, and death. So I did this. And I managed to, you know, stay in recovery. And one of the things that really does help people get into recovery is social support. And I got a lot of social support from those programs, which I attended every day for at least 5 years. So am I going to say, well, that's what everybody should do? No, because that really doesn't work for a lot of people.
Yeah, right. And I mean, if you weren't at Columbia or other places, if you were just a kid in Harlem or Queens or something else and you get arrested, you know, yeah, you're not getting the opportunities to even deal with any of this stuff. And
you know, I was extremely lucky. One of the reasons that I do the things that I do is because when I got arrested, I was facing 15 to life, a felony,
right,
under the Rockefeller laws for cocaine. And I'm a white woman, and I was also at an Ivy League school, and I had family, and I could show the judge after I came out of treatment, I went from this sort of 80-pound, very scary-looking person covered with tracks to somebody who had hope in my eyes again, and she saw that, and she said, I want to try to keep you out of prison. And she went to bat for me, even though the prosecutors were kind of like, well, we're not locking enough white people, so oftentimes, because this thing dragged out over 4 or 5 years, oftentimes I'd be the only white defendant in the courtroom. And it's just fucked up. I'm sorry. I hope I'm allowed to say that.
You are.
It's just like wrong. And I feel that like everybody should have the opportunities that I had, and that taking stuff away from people is the exact opposite of what you need to do when basically addiction is a cry for help.
Right. You're already down. Like you're already trying to scratch and claw.
I think, let's say it's a situation where you're in poverty. That's one hole you're in. Now you're addicted to drugs. That's another hole that you're in. Now you get arrested and you get a felony on top of that. And like, now what jobs are you going to get? What chance do you have out of getting out of any of these holes when you're three holes deep and then you've got something stamped on you that basically prevents you from ever being able to make anything out of yourself?
Well, I'm happy to speak to this. So right now, Colorado decided to create a felony for possession of fentanyl. And what that means is you have all kinds of disabilities in the future because it makes it really hard to get a job. It makes it really hard to get housing. It makes it really hard to find a partner. It makes it hard to do all of the things that we do that can actually get us out of addiction. It makes it much harder to recover. It increases self-hatred, it stigmatizes you, and it adds all of these things such as not being allowed to get housing and not being allowed to get food stamps, and it's infinite punishment. And we're in the midst of this fentanyl crisis. We have felonized drug possession in many states for many years. It did not work. Right. It does not work. Yeah. This is not what works. And yet we're still pushing back into this ancient, harmful stuff.
Yeah,
I got a question for you, Maya.
Oh, sure.
You said a lot of times you were the only white person in these courtrooms. What was something?
White defendant.
White defendant. That's what
white
I mean.
White defendant. There, you go. There were
there
lots you go. Of
Yeah, there was plenty
lawyers.
Of white people, but on the other side of
it. Yeah, we hang out at courts. Yeah,
right.
Some of the roles. Yeah.
So what was something that, was it anything that you noticed in the difference of how you were handled in the courtroom as opposed to some of the other defendants that were there that might have been black or brown?
Well, that's the thing. I just saw people hugging their families and going away for like 15 years.
Wow.
It was horrible. Most of the court appearances that I had were what's known as calendar dates. And you basically just have to sit there and wait through other people's cases till they get to yours. And so, I had a private lawyer. I just had an enormous amount of privilege. And it just broke my heart to see this. It just wasn't right. And the court that I was in actually was a special narcotics court. So most of the people there were just being sent for dealing. It was just horrifying. The whole system needs to be started in a better way from the ground up because this is not justice. It's just prejudice.
Right.
It wasn't some kind of medical decision that went into, okay, we'll make cigarettes legal and we'll make marijuana illegal, because you couldn't make a science-based decision on that. That had to be racism because it's just crazy. Like one of those drugs kills 50% of its long-term users. The other drug is not associated with reductions in lifespan at all. And that's the one that's illegal.
I guess the thing I think about is the opioid epidemic. We touched on it a little bit. I know people in the black community are like, oh, it's an epidemic now because it's affecting those people. But I think if it's getting people's eyes and it's making people that ordinarily weren't looking at drug addicts or users as human beings, then in a strange kind of messed up way, it's almost a good thing. It's almost a good thing if we could get these conversations open, if we could get these talks going about, you know, harm reduction and actually helping people. I think that's one good thing that's coming out of the negativity.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm glad you said that, because it's, if we get towards more compassionate and caring and respectful treatment for people with addiction, not only will we have a more humane society, we will also have more effective treatment.
Well, Maya, this has been amazing. Again, I think we could have talked to you for another you know, 3 hours. This could have been its own podcast series just on this. I want to thank you again for your time and sharing your story with us and your expertise on this issue. And you just don't realize the consequences of some of these issues and how the people that really need help and assistance are just not getting it anymore. Right. Again, thank you, Maya. I really appreciate this. And yeah, hopefully we'll talk to you soon, again soon.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you so much.
We have a few bills to pay, so we're going to go to a couple commercials right now.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Wow. Right off the bat,
the thing that's stuck with me since that interview was the story about the man and his wife holding each other's hands as he put a gun to himself, kill himself because he was aggressively
weaned off of opiates, the only thing that was actually giving him a quality of life for chronic back pain after a car accident.
Yeah, and he didn't go the illegal route, which was something that she said. She said most of them don't turn to the legal route.
Right.
They turn to the gun, and he turned to the gun. And this is prime example, like we say, this affects everybody.
Yeah.
And it impacts everybody. And so much of the stuff we've been talking about has been addicts, and we look at these people as drug users and criminals. And I think this one just kind of hits home. You know, sometimes we don't really have names or faces to go with these people. And we were able to, you know, find an obituary for J.O. Lawrence, age 58, of Hendersonville, Tennessee, passed away suddenly on March 2nd, 2017. And, you know, I think it's important just to say who he was to the people that cared about him most. I mean, he was a proud father, devoted husband. He has daughters. He has brothers. He has, this is a person that was important to the people in his life.
Yeah.
And is survived by his wife, Meredith Lawrence, who was arrested for assisting in his suicide and is on probation.
That's the craziest thing.
Yeah.
She literally has just lost the love of her life, the person that was, you know, trying to support their family. And she got caught up in the current because of the, I mean, if you don't think that's just screwed up,
that's a double blow to that family. And both blows came from the war on drugs.
Yeah. Instead of being like, what is happening where we allowed for that to be the most logical decision for this man in his head and his family.
Right.
So we said, oh, okay, the problem's not the laws. The problem is this woman.
Mm. Yeah.
Who held her husband's hand while he shot himself because he was in too much pain.
Yeah. It's insane. It's definitely backwards.
Man, it just gets frustrating. And like this one, any of us could be in this situation.
Easily.
Car accident, bad injury, sports, bicycling, whatever, picking up a friggin' box. Like we're old as shit now, Clayton. Like I wake up with stuff and I'm like, why is that sore? Like what's going on here? And I'm not doing anything. Like
My joints crack very loud.
Yeah.
I thought I got shot this morning. It was my shoulder.
Just jumped.
Yeah. I laid down.
Yeah. I mean, I read this quote from the doctor to that guy, and the last thing he said was, "My patient's quality of life is not worth risking my practice or my license over." We're forcing doctors to essentially remove a quality of life because they feel that they're going to be held liable, and they will. I mean, doctors have been criminally charged, not ones that are trying to run pill mills or anything, just trying to prescribe care. And we have these guidelines, and you know, the guidelines were supposed to be just kind of like advisory for doctors to kind of show, and obviously they became law in a lot of states, and were allowed to essentially target doctors who were prescribing above those guidelines, or around those guidelines. But cops can get at those lists of people that have prescriptions. That's a crazy thing too. Like you think your medical information's like protected. No, it ain't.
Right.
The feds think that they can get it regardless. And then a couple states require a warrant, but the other ones, it's just, we know what you're being prescribed, who's prescribing it. And the last thing you want to be is on the top of that list as a doctor.
Right.
It's crazy. And so luckily they're trying to change some of the laws around that. And also the CDC stopped labeling guidelines for like amounts. And they just said, doctors, use your caution and discretion to go about this. And then that allows for prosecutors, if someone's running a pill mill and has intent, is acting like a drug dealer selling these off, then they're still able to prosecute them. They don't need this at all. It just makes it easier. We just have to figure out this line at some point. And I want to thank Maya for coming out and talking to us and taking the time to hopefully educate a lot of y'all on this, because I think there's misconceptions about opiates and how they need to be utilized. And I think, you know, people went crazy when they first came out and they were pumped out in the system. And then we try to go completely the other way, and we're seeing the effects of that. And the CDC can change their guidelines, but states still have the laws in there. Prosecutors are still going to use these to prosecute doctors. It's going to have a chilling effect on prescriptions. I mean, terminally ill cancer patients can't get opiates. Last 30 days of their life, they're just in immense pain.
Right. When they should be, you know, coming to terms with the final days and reconciling with their family. Or
saying goodbye, doing everything.
If you could make it to where I could talk to my family in these last few days without being in excruciating pain or being extremely exhausted, that's the least you can give those people.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that real happy note, like all our episodes end on.
Yeah, all our episodes end like the beginning of Up, but it's okay.
We'll try to throw something in there a little bit more later. But with that, you know, I'm Greg Laud.
I'm Clayton English.
And thanks for listening. Make sure you follow the War on Drugs podcast so you don't miss any new episodes or any of our quick fix bonus content. I don't know if it actually helps, maybe if you follow it and unfollow it and then follow it again if we get two.
That don't count.
I don't know, maybe. You never know. Michael, mess with the algorithm a bit.
You cannot trick the algorithm.
We'll see. Maybe just give it a shot. What's the harm? But we'll be back next week with another episode of War on Drugs. Until then, thanks for listening.
Executive producers for War on Drugs are Jason Flom and Kevin Wardis. Senior producer is Michael Epstein. Editing by Nick Massetti and Michael Epstein. Associate producer and mix and mastering by Nick Massetti. Additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Anna McEntee.
Be sure to follow the show on all social media accounts. You know what they are. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Lava, like molten lava, for good. You can follow me on Twitter, at Greg Laud.
That's it? Just Greg Laud?
That's it.
That's it for
there's the nothing.
Twitter.
There's nothing fancy about me. It was available. Always will be. No one wants Glod in there. Yeah.
So you never have to go 1-2. You never have to go to Greg Glod.
Never happened in my life. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's me and my dad are the only two Greg Glods in the entire world. Yeah.
Is your dad's Gregory Glod?
We're
or
both.
He doesn't have a Twitter.
Oh, it even gets crazier than that. So, oh yeah, he doesn't have Twitter. Yeah, he couldn't get on Twitter if he tried. But the nice thing was I never had to buy a AAA membership when I was growing
right,
up because
yeah.
I just used my dad's name for everything.
Yeah.
Any membership or anything that he had, if I got in trouble, hey, Greg Laud right here.
Right.
Yeah, it's been perfect.
Right.
Yeah,
you've been a
well.
Grown-up
yeah.
since you were six.
Yeah, exactly.
Why does this kid have his own Costco card? Yeah.
You have Twitter, Instagram? What are you doing, working with?
Oh, yeah, you know, just Instagram over here, man. You know I don't have Twitter. Don't
okay.
do that. You know how I feel about that.
I know how you feel.
Yeah, but you can definitely follow me at Clayton English on Instagram.
War on Drugs is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company Number 1. I'm Greg Laud.
And I'm Clayton English.
Thanks for listening.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love comedy, movies, and Hollywood satire, you're going to want to listen to a brand new podcast called Get It to Dutch.
In Get It to Dutch, we play three aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a script to big-time Hollywood producer Dutch Huxley.
Each week on the podcast, we perform a movie script right before your ears.
It's like going to a movie with your eyes closed.
And we have amazing guest stars, including Tim Robinson, Rob Hubel, Lily Sullivan, Jamie Moyer, and Weird Al Yankovic.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, a screenwriter's journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was wooden!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.